Tax and say, what are we gonna give you?
And that's why I got no help from the business community at all. So we had Treasury, basically, and the White House staff has had to carry this entire battle by itself with the help of the Republican members of the Finance Committee and on the floor. And then the thing that's doing the House, basically.
I was in Grand Rapids last night, and I was praising the fact that the Senate won. And I would mention ADR to a group of businessmen. And it's amazing how damn few of them, John, know what ADR is. They're the most uninformed people on things that affect their business that I've ever known.
Well, Jerry, this is why they have no influence anymore.
I couldn't believe it.
This thing's kicked around now for years, you would recall. All this year, it's been in the news. You remember, we got attacked, the Treasury got, we adopted the rules, we got attacked by Mayor, we had a long hearing, the papers every day, the columnists were writing about it. Yet when you come up for a vote on the floor, either the House or Senate, you get no support.
Let me take it for granted.
Right.
Let me ask you this, when do you need this,
we may get another vote today or tomorrow, certainly by tomorrow.
And this time, he's coming up with a plan that's coming out.
Well, 10% doesn't give you enough incentive either, so no.
At least 20% of our...
He didn't even wire.
He didn't vote on...
Who do you want the wires to? Who do you want them to come into?
Well, they should go into...
Well, I mean, who should they go into?
No, we could give it to none of ours. It's the parts in the...
The guys that are going to be with us anyway.
Especially the shore up on the Republicans.
You shore up, sure, the member of Republicans.
Give a list, you will get a list to Clark by noon today.
By God, you get somewhere.
We have to be lucky, we have to spend on ourselves.
Oh, you're right.
Don't check the current addresses.
But we're losing the Democrats largely on a partisan issue because nobody's made an issue with it.
Some of the Democratic senators have said they have not been contacted by one single constituent in behalf of the ADR.
Governor Rutledge. First, he's done a very good job on the floor.
First, he's old, yes.
He has a chance. He's done a very good job.
First, he's good, you know. He's very good.
Dr. Warren, and he's been established.
Well,
just by the last thing,
you know, he's coming here, you know, a lot of people in this country.
Not a single person has even called me or done anything else.
Not even written them.
So I don't understand what you're talking about.
Okay.
These telegrams don't do any good unless they come from here.
From people, but they say their own, it's also telephone calls.
They're the one who say, we know who their major people are. It's important to come up with calls and bring them up.
In fact, the last thing they question, what kind of reason do we have to substitute due bill for the bank?
Fairly good. We think we can work out something.
We've been pulling our hair out of it. It's just a lot of it happened in the past. We're not getting very comfortable with it. Jerry does, but I'm, you know, I don't know. This is a plan of that kind of thing. We know what to do. We want to do everything we can to on that substitute.
Well, we'll obviously be in touch with you and working on it to try to see what we have to do, what we have to take, in order to get a dollar that
maybe. And incidentally, just to get the ball, we all know here that a tax bill is going to pass in first round. Would you be surprised if some business guy that is in here is telling you?
No.
Would you be surprised if a lot of these clowns up there is... Oh, we're not sure about the tax bills, but we're going to have to see if we can market it now.
It's not amazing.
Our God. And of course, if you see my point, guys, let me say it. You say, well, what is the wage for it? What's the price for it? And what's the wage for it? Believe me, if we get a damn good tax bill across here, that's going to have a very, very bullish effect on the economy. Right, John?
Yes, sir. Mr. President, I want to emphasize something Don said. I just was never taught in your district or anywhere else just about the pay board, the price commission. Talk about this tax bill, because this tax bill has more incentives in it. It has more benefits than any tax bill in a long, long time, if ever. If we've had an equal to it. My God, you're getting the excise tax, you're getting the job development credit for business, you're getting the ADR, you're getting the debt, your proposal, at least at this point, which in effect keeps jobs at home, and even though labor has opposed it, there's more sex appeal from the standpoint of American workmen in this proposal than anything I know of. Because what you're doing future, you can just say that this is a provision that will stop the exploitation of American jobs. And it's just that simple. And just talk about the personal exemptions, there's an enormous stimulus in this tax bill. There's enormous interest in this tax bill. And the reason was to provide the economic stimulus for business, to provide the jobs, and to reduce unemployment. So it has to be talked about. At the same time, you talk about the pay board, the price commission, because they address themselves to the problem of inflation. You have the dual problem, the twin problem, of slowing inflation and increasing the opportunity for employment. So you just have to talk about both as you go along to give a full picture. Now on the, Mr. Ferguson, I'll take one more minute.
Oh, sure.
On the international side, believe me, and if I were y'all, this is where you can make some real hay. Now, the president can't do it, but you all can do it. My God, you can take the figures on what's happening around the world and the way that the United States is being mistreated, the fact that he's the first president who tries to bring some stability and some equity and some fairness out of our meetings with our partners around the world. And if you can't make this appeal to everybody in your district, I don't know anything about politics. But I used an example in Tokyo. I said, well, all we want is equity. We don't want an advantage of anybody, but we want to be treated fairly for a change. Why does a Pinto automobile cost $2,000 or $2,200 in California? Why does a Datsun cost a little less than that? But why does a Pinto in Japan cost $5,200? What's fair about it? Now that's the truth of the matter. Now they say they're going to liberalize their quota system. So they do. They do it on wide feet for those of you in the Midwest. Peter in Colorado raised the tariff. So they raised the tariff to $135 a head. Now that's about the equivalent of the total value of a 300-pound animal, which is what they'd be shipping over there because they want the light weights. So now they say, you talk to some of your insurance company people, you can't sell life insurance in Japan. You can't do it. No American company is permitted to do it. Now they can do it here. Our banking people have a little old corner drugstore type banks over there, and they think they're killing a big haul. But the truth of the matter is, that there are two Japanese banks. I told the president of the banks in Ambassador Holm, the residence, the other day, I said, you got more money, more assets, more footings in your two banks in California than every foreign bank in the world has in Japan. You tell me this is a fair deal? I don't believe it. That's not my sense of equity. And so you can make these types of things. Take the Philippines. You don't have to just jump on Japan. You talk about the flexible farm program restraints in Europe. If they have a bad crop, we can ship a lot of stuff to them. But they've got flexible rates, so if they have a good year, they just squeeze us out. Now, you talk about fairness in Europe, and we're being criticized by saying we're too tough. And they talk about this Texas cowboy, he don't mend his ways, we're going down the drain. Well, I'm not. I wish I could claim to be a cowboy, because I don't know any that I don't like. They got a hell of a lot greater virtues than a lot of folks I know. But the truth of the matter is, one way you have a cowboy does understand, and that means you can ride a good horse to death. If you got a good one, you better take care of it. But they've about ridden the United States horse to death. Now, they say equity, they talk about being fair. Why is it that we get 30% of Japan's exports to the world market? You know how much goes to the European community? 5%. Why? Not because the Japanese love us so much they want to share their products with us instead of the Europeans. They'll sell it wherever they can. The reason they don't sell more to Japan to the European Union is because they won't let them in. That's why. Now let's take a little country. Let's take the Philippines that we have some little association with for 7 years. But all they did recently is file the Laura Langley Act under which we treat the Philippines more favorably than any country on the face of the earth. No matter what the taxes are, they don't, or import duties or tariffs, theirs is only 80% of the average, of the lowest, rather, of the average. They've got the best deal in their relations with the United States of any country on earth. and in violation of the Laurel Land Amendment, they recently just stopped all exports of textile remnants and used clothing from the United States. And these were two of the biggest items we shipped them. They just prohibited them. We can't ship anything. And we've done nothing about it, but we said, oh, well, the Laurel Land Amendment runs out in 1974. But we have a deficit trade with the Philippines. The United States does. We're in a deficit position, and yet we permit them to do that. They put in a restriction over there that precluded us from shipping knockdown cars to them. The only people that could qualify under their specifications were the Japanese. Now, we finally protested, we begged, we pled, and we finally got them to amend their orders to where we could get in our contract markets. But this is still something. Now, at the same time they're doing that to us, they turn around, instead of us shipping them 4,000 or 400,000 metric tons of wheat next year, they just ordered 200,000 from Canada, with which they have a deficit. They've got a surplus with us, but they go order their wheat from Canada at the same time they're imposing restrictions on us in clear contradiction of the Laurel Langley agreement between us to keep out most of our exports now. Now this is the sort of thing that's happening to us all the time. I just mentioned these to you so that we can give you 1,000 examples if you want. But I don't think the administration can't be in the position of being protectionist in its character or trying to build a tariff wall. I'm not trying to say these things to you to reflect any vote in the House and Senate because it would be wrong. The president has to be responsible in terms of the responsibilities that this nation has to its partners around the world. But in terms of local politics, I can't think of anything that would strengthen your hand more than what the president's doing in trying to bring about some equity and some sense of fairness in our trading with other countries.
Mr. Secretary, if you could get that to us, it would be very helpful in the business around
that. Would be exactly.
As a matter of fact, John, I feel you covered this on several occasions. If you could just include what you have said on that, one of your own talks. I'm going to do anything that I should get it around because all of us, you recall, for example, and you recall when I got on the speech in the Congress when I talked to this program, remember what the biggest applause line was when I said, we want to help other countries, but it's time for the United States to look after its own interests. Now, let me say, you, senators and congressmen, can take a hell of a lot different line than I can. I mean, after all, I got to talk to the French and the British and so forth about things that go beyond trade. And we have to use, the Japanese, for example, we were talking to them about a hell of a lot of things that don't have anything to do. But that really, I can't go as far as this. But if I were a senator or a congressman and also help us in our foreign relations generally, staying in our hands, there's no reason at all for a senator or congressman speaking up for his constituents to say that the United States, in terms of trade barriers, in terms of a new monetary system that will properly reflect things that the United States is now due for a better shake, and that we have an administration standing up and saying this, fighting for it. This is far bigger than cutting foreign aid of it. Believe me, this should be the case. It's all marvelous. You look at that, what was the deficit in the third quarter? I'll find that payment. They sold $12 billion more a year than we sold abroad. Well, now we've got a trillion-dollar economy, so it's going to bust us. But on the other hand, it does indicate that we have been a little bit more fair than we need to be. And you can ring the changes on this. Now, if you get into something, you're talking to me, I would recommend this before or the Foreign Policy Committees and Councils in Cleveland or Philadelphia. There's all these people that think they're great internationalists doing that, given the usual gun you like to hear. But believe me, on this side, you're talking to business guys. I mean, I don't mean the New York Times, but I mean you're talking to the average fellow, to the average audience, and so forth. He very properly should hear that we have an administration, sure, we want to be responsible internationally, and we are. We're carrying our share of the load internationally, and so forth. We will continue to. And we're not going to take the kind of an attitude toward them that they've taken toward us. But in this whole field of international trade, we're willing to compete, but the rules have got to be fair. It's got to be a two-way street. We're going to change this game now. And that's what we're trying to do, and that's why we're hanging tough. And so
we don't give one damn about the editorials in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Newsweek, and all the rest of Harvard about this thing.
Who are their constituents?
Hell, not yours. Their constituents are this international community who frankly are live off of this kind of trade. Well, I'm putting this case a little stronger than some. I mean, you will find there's another viewpoint that you will hear very vigorously expressed, like when I spoke to the New York editor. The attitude of the New York editor is a hell of a lot different from the attitude of Mr. Company. People put up a lot of money, $800,000, and that was good. They're our friends, but basically they are people who live on, frankly, trade with Europe, let's face it, and to a lesser extent, trade with Japan. And they want to be real nice. In other words, they're just trying to control that kind of stuff. Let's not get into that. My point is, all this whole situation of how do we come out, having taken this big bet on August of energy, letting the dollar float, trying to get a new system, monetary system, which the United States does not assume all the responsibility and convertibility of this. Having taken this step ahead, then we're not going to get rid of one unsound system by substituting for another system that's unsound and not in the interest of the United States. Why do we have to take this step? Because of those third, fourth quarter figures, we knew those were going to come out in a week of this battle. I mean, this nothing obviously came back to these figures. Now, you cannot continue to run a $15 billion budget and have a negative trade deficit every quarter, over and over again, without eventually just really having an enormously bad effect on returns and everything else. So we've taken the step to stop the flow of blood. Having taken that, now we're going to try to cure the disease.
Mr. President, if you were forecasting when these countries would make some modifications, when would you believe they might mature?
Jerry, it's difficult to say. Up to now, this is one thing you ought to be constantly aware of, in spite of what President Hamboud has said. Remember that we are making overtures. We're negotiating all the time. We're doing our utmost to bring about a solution to this problem, and we're going to keep on. Or do it in a very fair and a very equitable way. We're not as
hard. Every one of these countries said to
that. But we are looking in Canada. We got a team in Canada talking to them right now. We've had a team over in Europe. I just came back from Japan. I don't know. Now, the truth of that is that in spite of the fact that we were criticized by these same countries all spring for running these tremendous steps, they have said absolutely nothing to us. They even forthcoming with nothing except they said, we want to be cooperative. We know you got a problem. We want to help. But that's it. The only solution they propose from any source up to this point is that y'all remove the surcharge and you agree to change the price slowly. And then we'll talk to you. Now that's where we are.
Sounds like communist negotiators.
That's right. And anybody that we ought to trade and negotiate on that basis, I can't understand them. So that's all that they
do. We remove the surcharge. Let's go back to that. Incidentally, there are people. You will find that the financial circles, even within the administration, that argue this, that they just remove the surcharge and raise the price of gold. What do you really do?
Well, this is very technical. But what you really do is to go back to a system of convertibility. And you're out of the surcharge. And with nothing gained. Now, if you raise the price of gold, although some will say, well, that doesn't really mean you're going back to convertibility, that's what they really want. That's what foreigners want. So you raise the price of gold, it means that we, in effect, are going to say, well, we're going to have to go back to an old system and raise the price of gold. It'll be a little sounder, but no change on the trade, no change on the barriers. As far as we're concerned. And this is the area that we've got to get some changes made.
Mr. President,
yeah.
Speaking of the New York type.
Yeah. North of New York.
Yeah. I'll accept your message. I think we got to be careful not to get trapped in our rhetoric in this. The Secretary is pretty darn persuasive. And the important thing as far as Congress is concerned,
is that you're exercising your discretion and your leadership in this field, and you have the flexibility to use it intelligently. But the Democrats are going to want to take the initiative away from you and do that only by passing the kind of inflexible, quota-type legislation that we can't ever get away from again. And it's awfully important to stress the necessity for presidential leadership, as you say it, so we don't get locked in on something
that could be in our... You couldn't be more right if you go to... I know that's an awfully tough thing to vote against, but if you if they go for it, inflexible. I mean, a mandatory, that's what I agree with, mandatory, quota-type legislation, or... Inversely mandatory, because when they put it all down here, the heat will be pretty tough to find what they're up to.
But that's one of the dangers of congressmen hitting this awfully hard, because people say, well, you're relying on the president, what are you doing? And the problem is the legislative solution.
I think all we want here, I think it just creates what we're trying to do. We believe the Secretary of the Treasury is correct in his attempt to negotiate hard for the best interest of the United States. We're not being unreasonable. We're willing to make a good deal. We don't want more than this, what is ours, and not even half, not even as much. You know, let me give you an example of it. You know, I know a lot of the bleeding hearts have been, you know, saying, well, what are we doing about refugees in Pakistan? Right? I mean, some of our Republicans have been talking about it. Now, look, I'll tell you what we're doing. And I go, Mrs. Scott, this. I said, look, you know what? She was interested about the refugees. I said, this is refugees in Pakistan and in India, too, you know, they're not too bad, right? The United States today has put up more than all of the rest of the world combined. Her foreign secretary, Harry Bennett, you can see me just before about the whole issue, said, did we have a great statement from the French? We have a one-mind statement from the British. I said, how much did they put up? They put up a damn thing at that point. And I said, well, as soon as they put up just half as much as we have, and you come tell me what they say. I'm not getting into the India-Pakistan. It's a great agony. The main thing for us is to avoid getting involved in a war there, and the main thing for us is to avoid taking spies on it. Because believe me, there are two sides, not just the Indian side. I'm sure it's okay. And the point that I make, though, is this. You talk about the United States. We say, well, we're rich. Sure, we're rich. The 300 million Europeans could certainly do as much as the United States is doing in the India-Pakistan thing. And they're not doing it. We're putting up already more than the rest of the world combined. That's it. That's for refugees. Now, so we are being generous. This administration is being generous. We're saying, however, that in this field, in order for the United States to continue to be generous, the United States economy has to be healthy. The world has an enormous stake in the success of our policies. An enormous stake. Because if the United States economy is not healthy, this country will inevitably turn inward. If you think it's isolationist now, it will become totally isolationist. If we continue to have unfavorable balances of trade, continue to have economic problems at home, as the United States is strong and healthy economically at home, the United States will have a strong and vigorous outward-looking foreign policy. But when it goes the other way, it'll go the other way. And that's what we have to have in mind here. This is in the best interest of the world, so we... I think it's very important. I mean, it depends on where you are. Now, let's use the demagogues a little more than some of the rest of you. And it does. Because I've been in his district, John Melvin, and the rest of them. He's been bringing changes. I don't know. Rose did a pretty good job. But what I'm saying is that it leaving like it is, we do have a valid case, indeed. We have a case where for 25 years, the United States has carried the major burden of foreign aid. The United States has carried the major burden for the defense of the world. And still the first one. And the United States, in terms of trade, has accepted restrictions against us that we did not apply against other countries. We were able to do that. We could afford that luxury because trade means infinitely more, let's face it, to the Japanese than it does to us. It means infinitely more to Europe than it does to us. It's only 4 to 5% of our GNP. It's the Japanese is 25 to 30 or something like that. Having said all that, Now the United States admits that we're broke. This is, we're doing pretty well, actually. And you go to these other countries and you realize that all this crap that we attract from others in the United States, you know, all this poverty and all the other stuff, 90% of any, the poor of the United States would be rich 90% of the world today. You're going to take back instead of being fed to Indonesia and do these other things. But my point is, in this field of trade and monetary policy, and monetary policy really is only important as it relates to trade and investment, etc. In this field, there needs to be a new deal. That's all we're asking. And a fair deal. A new and a fair deal. We're not trying to, if it doesn't, we're going to say, well, now because this has been unfair to us, we're going to be unfair to you. We're not doing that. As a matter of fact, we accept something that will still, we are bigger, we are richer economically, and we can give more than we receive. But we can't give as much as we're giving. That's all we're saying here. And the others have not yet, as John has said, made any offer of significance. All they have offered to do is to say, look, get rid of your surtax, and go back to a different form of the system that was unsound before. But we're not going to do that. That's where you look at it now. We can't do that. Because I can tell you, from a political standpoint, that wouldn't be good for you policy. You can't go back and sell that. Well, why'd you have surcharge in the first place? You got rid of it, so now you're going back, you've got an accident. So after that unfavorable balance of trade in the third quarter comes out, if the United States now moves to get rid of this surcharge without getting some mutual action on the other side, what would you say is a critic? I mean, our Democratic friends now, and I understand how they, if you're on the other side, you just criticize whatever goes on, and then turn around and criticize the other side and you change it. And so what happens here? They're raising hell because, as always said, we're causing repercussions with our friends abroad. It's true. It's true. The Japanese are not happy about this, and the British and French and Germans. We don't want the world to gang up on us. We're working with the Canadians because we don't want to have bad relations with Canada. The Latin Americans are sensitive. Like, it wouldn't matter, and we can get rid of that tomorrow without our reason. But when you really come down to it, let us assume that we can be there right now for all the criticisms and got rid of the surcharge and got nothing for it except change the price of gold. Well, let me tell you, if I were a Democratic partisan on the other side, I'd kick the living bejesus out of us. Why are we stirring anything up just for this? And who's going to speak up for America? Look, if you think we have been speaking up for America, then watch those clowns we get the demagogues, because they've forgotten more about demagoguery than most of us will ever learn. But we're doing all right. Let me say, let me put it a little bit more positive note on it. I think the thing that all of you should say at Barbary, particularly in your New York community, and Peter, you run into a lot of these people too, and some of the rest you run into some stuff, you do too. The thing you would say is that this administration, and it seems like it's working, we're working daily, we're working around the clock to try to find an equitable solution to this problem. We are against a protectionist system where the surcharge was announced as temporary, it will be temporary. We want to work the problem out, but we have not yet gotten to the point where our trading partners abroad have been willing to come halfway. When they do come halfway, a deal will be made, and we're hopeful that one will be made. I'd be rather confident. I speak confidently and hopeful. One will be made, right, John?
Yes.
I think it's well to speak that way, but I have to say that we're not just going to make a bad deal. We're going to make a good one, and they're going to make a good one. We expect them to bargain hard, and we're going to bargain hard. That's what's different in this game. But the United States, in its international trade, has not bargained hard for 25 years. The goddamn State Department has been terrible in this deal. And we are changing the game, that's all. Now it's tough, but it's the way it's going to be done.
Mr. President, can we say if we're asked that there have been no offers from the leading nations, John?
Yeah, sure. Try to say nothing.
No meaningful.
They would say, we know you have a problem. We got to help.
We'll cooperate.
But having said that, what do you
call it?
surcharge, but we can't relax. Unconditional surrender. I've had four countries come in to see me that I would have
different. That's quite Australia, France, Belgium, and Japan. And they don't offer that thing except raise the price of gold.
That's right, yeah.
Exactly right. Well,
now, Japan, let's take them as an example. They talk about a depression. You know what's happened in Japan? Their exports this year, the first 8 months, are 25% above what they were last year. That's how much of a depression they got. And Canada talks about a recession. Their last quarter, they just had an 8% real growth is all, 8%. Germany talks about the imposition of the surcharge going to cause a recession. I met with economists all summer, and they were predicting that Germany would have a recession this December before the end of the year, long before August 15th, long before the import surcharge was put into effect, simply because they've had such a higher rate of growth in economic activity. They've imported it. They're overemployed in Germany, have been for years. They've imported people from Portugal, Spain, Italy, Austria, all over Europe.
Unemployment is less than 1%.
That's right.
Less than 1%.
Well, this is I think the one thing that you should knock down on this idea that the United States is fighting for in this administration is, my God, there's never been a more international administration for a long time around this place. Maybe you don't do it anymore. But anyway, the second thing is that we are being unreasonable and parochial to the rest. We're not being unreasonable, parochial. We are for simply a new and sounder system of international exchange and international trade. That's in our interest and it's in their interest in the long run. It's time to build it. This is the time. That's what we're fighting for. We've got to hold the line here. And if you speak up on this point, if our Democratic friends, some of them, I mean the partisans, not great figures. So
how the hell would you run the Senate without a man like men like Stennis and others? How would you do it, really?
It'd be terrific. And how would you do the House, Jerry, without some of your fellows over there? Terrific. Jerry, of course, you've got a marvelous Republicans over there. And you've got off the road with your... But I would say that if the Democratic partisans start kicking us around too much about, well, we're jeopardizing our relation with our friends, it's international, and all that sort of thing, then I think they will deserve a good kick in the pants. On the ground now, here, these are the administrations that over the years simply haven't stood up for the United States, and it's time, by God, somebody did, and I did. So got a pretty responsive audience. As I say, if your audience is not in the barber state, I will write all of New York or Minneapolis, Chicago, parts of
San Francisco. Mr. President, everybody supports the expression of your sentiments in the business community, too. They may worry about it, but they still think you're doing the right thing. So
we're fighting up. But the point is, where we are being reasonable. I got to, you know how I feel about the quarter. I quote it all the time. How I feel about we don't want to do this. That isn't the way to do it. I don't want the United States to turn angry. That is good from us from a point that's far more important than how many bucks we make. As I've often said, once a country turns inward, it ceases to be a great country. We want to compete, but we want it to be fair. That's all.
The tough Democrats on the other side, though, are going to hit you from the same side that you haven't gone far enough, and they're going to want to have congressional solutions because of organized labor.
Because of organized labor. I know there's a meeting that's saying that, I don't know how you figured this out, but our policy was that it's affecting exporting jobs. That is the opposite. He's pretty flexible.
Yeah. That's what I left on the paper.
I was just about to make the remark that it's so easy to tie the domestic program and the foreign program together, because as the domestic program works, it will ease tension on the foreign situation. As we are able to lower our unit costs of production, we get a better hand in the poker game as far as international trade is concerned. And I just want to congratulate the administration on tying it so beautifully together. It makes it a lot easier for all of us. And certainly the picture up ahead is much brighter than it was before August 5th.
Let me include this to the members tonight. We've got a very important vote in the House, and I'm going to read it for you. First, as Tom Rumsfeld said, don't let the debate now simply be based on the pay board and the price commission. If you do, they'll nickel and dime you to death. What about this decision and that one? And what about that drug store and entire race and gas prices are too high or grocery prices are too low or about economy? Don't let remember this has been a three-legged stool throughout. It's the question that you have the wage, you have we want to control wages and prices. We have a job program, and that's where the tax bills come in, and the job development credit and all the rest. And we have, of course, an international program, which is also related to jobs. International programs that has to do with getting American products a fair break in the world. And keep before the country the fact that what we said on August 15th went far further than simply saying, look, we're going to have price controls. Inflation price controls can be very popular for a while, and then unpopular after it affects individual people enough. I think it's important to keep that all in mind. And they can ask that out of this international stuff. So let them just keep us on the back. It's the right thing to do. Well, could we have a brief report here? You want to tell us particularly how about the Supreme Court judges you need?
Well, you recall, Mr. President, that I asked last year if you'd be willing to stay as long as necessary. Confirmed, and he said that yes, it did, it would. Now, 7 days run on Thursday in the committee. At that point, I suspect that I will call us in, and they'll perhaps make the point of order that Senate's in session after a while. I'd like to persuade the chairman to hold meetings early in the morning or late at night if necessary to win Brother By. We only have four possible opponents in that committee, and two of them will be quiet. By Hart Kennedy, the White Senator, that's it. Well, I'm proud of that. Next year. I think we can get to that. We've got to put up with this nonsense and delay for a while.
Incidentally, could I suggest to this, our House members could get this one. This delay of this court taking is compared with this time of Bob Griffin, with great statesmanship, delaying another proclamation, but this delay now is unconscionable. The court has, Ms. Berger will tell you, has an enormous backlog. There are very important cases, including busing, which I know you're all for, and all that sort of thing. And if this isn't right to have those cases decided by 7 members, well, look at that, MT, because 4-3. See, we've got things like that now, and basically, we, under our system, we expect it to be 4-3 the other way. We wouldn't have catched the shot, so that's what we've been taught. But what my point is, you've got two judges. The court should have, we should have 9 judges on there. And I also, this business on the ideological side, I'm speaking out as a House member, as well as Senate, we follow that treaty. But on the ideological side, I saw our Joe Rao, for example, the EPA said, well, Brent Bush is on the far right. Let's assume he is on the far right. I don't think he is. Don't say that I didn't say he's on the far right. But nevertheless, let's assume he is. Where was Joe Rao when they appointed that man Douglas to the court? He's on the far left. Did anybody raise any questions about Douglas? Or Brennan, or for that matter, Black. Black, who was a fine lawyer, you've got to give him credit, one of the smartest guys in the court, but was on the left of every decision that ever came down. Where were all these ideological arguments when Frankfurter was appointed? Now, Frankfurter was very interestingly enough a new dealer on the left, and then in turn, as he became a lawyer at the end. That's right, he became a strict constructionist, which, of course, but what I'm saying is this, that we can pull the teeth of this argument about qualification as these are two top flight men. They're good men. They're going to call them to see him. But say, Powell's going to vote, I think Dick will agree, he's going to vote every way I like. I mean, I don't find any agree to everything anyway, and none of us will. And neither will Rehnquist. I can't tell you right today where Rehnquist stands in a lot of things. But I know these are good lawyers. they're going to recognize it's their job to interpret the laws rather than make the laws, which is your job. But by God, we need that down here.
Virginia, I have no case against them. All they're doing is trying to...
I know you have, so get some others to do it.
We're doing our best, and I've announced that if by delays this professional way, I'm going to be taking on personally at every job we can throw the market in.
Right.
They're always trying these people for what they think they believe. They don't even know what they believe.
Well, this fellow, what was it? This poor Lindquist kind of a gentleman. What do you do?
He was a poll watcher.
A poll watcher?
Yes.
Well, you said last from voting.
Well, what he did was keep up people who were not registered from voting and kept them from voting graveyards, which they did in Arizona for years.
Well, he said that.
Of course, I remember, well, we had quite an operation going. He was one of the leaders.
We were all over the country.
How do we ever get those guys in Chicago approved?
I don't know.
The rest is brief. The continuing resolution should come up right after the second tax amendment. Today we would hope to finish the tax bill. Did you say Wednesday or Thursday, Bob?
Friday.
Yeah, Mr. Standing that a lot of amendments still pending, and we'll get it. That's about it.
There's one coming up on political contributions that I'm very concerned about. And people are getting together over there, and they've got 6 hours for this thing, and I don't know.
The long amendment on the charges, I think it is too.
Yeah.
It's the old amendment that passed once before, check a dollar off your income tax or something. They're very secretive about what the package is.
Yes, the leaders did an excellent, your leaders did an excellent job yesterday when we had to bring in the mayor, Mansfield, handling that situation. We couldn't, you know, there were some who advised us to sort of temporize with it, go ahead, because we should have paid these people. But that would have made us hostage to the Senate. For every damn amendment they wanted to pass for these authorizations, we couldn't possibly do it. Most of them were legal.
But the price you pay, though, sir, I bet you're going to have to see that movie on my show.
I've heard you commit yourself on a high five.
Bye. I must say, though, I'll tell you, the guy in the honor, here's a guy I took. I'd like to be as tenacious at 60 as he is at 80.
Yeah.
That's about all. He's a tiger.
He is a tiger.
He really is. And I admire him for it. He's wrong most of the time.
The president is association with Benson on 54 to 57, and it was the chance to replay the entire farm crisis, as they call it, and would be helpful. Some of the House members, of course, some of the House members who once had old had another professor and so forth. But I think it would probably be supported by the committee that there'd be a chance to get out of conversation on farm problems and land administration. Trying to abolish the Department of Agriculture and then backing up the...
Well, you finished that, of course, you're
right. So, that was part of the bar and the Senate Ag Committee that might be a subject.
Ms. Larkin is going to talk to you. I don't know whether it will help.
Yes, sir. We've set up appointments for a lunch at breakfast this morning here with Senator Jack Miller.
Yeah.
And it was a lengthy breakfast. We have sessions today with Bill Dionne and with Herman Talmadge, and the confirmation hearing is 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Mr. President, we have a real fight today, probably today. Eddie Boland is going to offer limitations on the Defense Department appropriation bill. We've taken the initiative. John's called a conference at 10:30 to discuss it. We've worked with Clark. If we can beat this one, I think we probably good in their major efforts. Now, we've got a problem. Howard Robinson, who has been against this a good bit of the time, has drafted a limitation that would conform to the version that was in your military procurement bill, Wes.
The Mansfield language
in the military procurement authorization. Now, the question is, should we meet head-on the Bolin Amendment? Or should we go along with the substitute that Howard Robinson was going to offer them? We pick up, what, I would guess 15 votes maybe. If we work with Howard, and I presume we would lose that many votes if we just stay stuck on the Bolin Amendment. It was awfully close, and some of the Democrats were telling us yesterday, George Andrews, who's been pretty staunch, Jamie Whitten, who's been pretty staunch, according to George Mahon, are wavering a little bit now.
Andrews is spooky because he's been redistricted in the middle there.
Jerry, if you yield.
Sure.
I've got these two amendments here, and the amendments from the Bolins is a real, is terrible. It's much worse than the Mansfield language, because while in the first part of it they refer to the military to come back to 1971, then in the middle they just go off on their own and say that none of the funds appropriated by this act shall be used to finance any military combat or support operations. U.S. forces in or over South Vietnam, North Vietnam, Laos or Cambodia after June 1st, 1972. Not tied to the release of prisoners at all. I mean, the first part of it talks about that, but it does not tie it down.
Is that the Bolin Amendment?
That's the Bolin Amendment.
I go up or down then.
Well, but Mr. President, the problem is somebody undoubtedly is going to offer a substitute. And
well, you realize, let me tell you, everybody's ex-prisoners.
Right.
Well,
indeed.
Jamie Whitten, you want to have one string of the bow or two?
I want that too.
That's the point.
Yeah.
And so you can say to the enemy, look, in return for, if you give us our prisoners, we'll get out by June 1st. All right, so you want that string or do you want to have something else?
Well, we can beat the Bolin Amendment, but I'm sure we're not going to be faced with this tonight when we vote.
Yeah.
There's no new substitute offered. The question, I guess, is whether or not we want to encourage a Republican to do it. Get whatever credit there be, or whatever we want to let down, just fall where they may, let Jamie Whitten or somebody like that offer one, we find out makes too much sense. All right, here's Howard. Notwithstanding any other provisions in this act, none of the funds appropriated by this act shall be used to finance any military combat or support operations by U.S. forces in or over South Vietnam, North Vietnam, Laos, or Cambodia, which are not in accordance with and designed to implement Title VI of the Military Procurement Act of 1971, calling for termination of all U.S. military operations in Indochina at the earliest practical date, subject to the release of all American prisoners. Of course, I'd rather not have any of them, but I should think the better strategy, if you want my opinion, would be to have Robinson go ahead and offer his amendment as a substitute. All of us vote for it and then vote against it, assuming it's adopted, vote against it until the final.
It would certainly be better to get rid of Bolin by one means or another.
Right.
Let's get rid of the Bolin Amendment. This gets a substitute, then people can vote for or against Robinson as the substitute.
This gets rid of the inexorable cutoff date.
You don't think you can get Bolin up or up or down.
Right now.
And you got a Republican taking on the president.
Number eight, because this is the Title VI language, which was in the I don't know how to trust the
president. I actually was treated as a Mansfield Amendment. I think so too, and there was so little press on the Mansfield Amendment as it came out of your committee that I think they got tired of writing about it.
They didn't even ask for a separate vote on it. When we made that possible, one of the three parts of it. I was made, but they didn't ask for it. That was a chance to get a good vote on it. They didn't ask for it. I think maybe it shimmered down a little bit, but you ought to talk to
Congress takes into its hands by passing any amendment responsibility to get the fate of South Vietnam, but responsibility to the fate of those prisoners. Now that's the cold turkey deal. If I were a congressman, I would vote for no amendment. Because they, any restriction in place, they know damn well.
Why are you putting this in?
They know damn well we're moving out. They know very well we're working on the prisoners. They know very well that I made a 2-month announcement because
we felt that it was important not to have a buildup in the passes in the ski months in December and January. Now, I know all the politics, sure. They want to get out in front and say, well, we voted and forced the president to go out. What the hell were they doing in 1966, 67, and 68? What were they doing then? It was then that 300,000 Americans went in, and casually went up to 300. And in 1969, 70, and 71, 400,000 Americans have come down, and casually has gone down to 5. And that's a total turkey proposition. As far as the UWs are concerned, when did most of them go over there? Before we ever got to this place. How are you going to get them out? So you can say, well, they're going to stay in the UW. We might get out of South Texas as quickly as we can, consistent with getting out our prisoners and so forth, which is to create, get out the prisoners. Put yourself in the position of a tough, hard, and what's he going to say? Fine, what else you got to offer? They have said they've already turned that down, you know, in Paris. They've turned down the 6 month proposition, they've turned down this proposition, and said no. Until the United States discontinues its economic assistance to such deals and overthrows Cuba, those two are the last conditions they have. We will not release the prisoners. This is pure crap. That's what it is. Now, all I'm saying is this, and I think that the best thing to do, frankly, is to fight it. My proposition is this, fight it, lose it. And the Congress takes the responsibility for the failure to get the prisoners back. I don't think in this instance that if the test is on this amendment, I just don't have to come around, come up straight again. Right now, Jerry, it's a very critical period. It's a very critical period. We just made a very significant announcement, greater than 2,500. And for the Congress now to indicate lack of confidence in the president's leadership, more than the other guys. In other words, those that got us in the war are sabotaging our efforts to get us out. That's what it is, cold turkey. And for them to do this at this point, so be it. And then, with the responsibility right there, I can tell you this. Any amendment will jeopardize our efforts to get the prisoners back. Because you put some position. Suppose the enemy, all your option is because of what the Congress did. They have to wait. And then at least the Congress has got to pull the chain on the plug. Or suppose they think that your option might be, in the event that they didn't play, and we may, as we have very numbers of offers that are going to do, that we might have to use our power against North Vietnam.
Good.
Not saying we're going to, but they might think so. Because after all, after Cambodia and Laos, you see, that makes that a hell of a lot more credible. And that's the way you have to play this. So I'm just saying that cold turkey, that's all the damn amendments you want. And that's the kind of speaking to you in the broad sense, the kind of pass on it. Any amendment, this president will make it more difficult.
And this president, another man in the other chart, says, tossing over the bill on giving CAB control over the international rate, that area, which is affecting the bill, and the president has to review and set aside because it is. They have a meeting at 10 o'clock with the Congress Committee because they want to force the thing through because of some kind of a conference in Honolulu next week. And they're coming up with an amendment this morning that does this, puts in the hands of CAB, and only on notice because it removes the power of review. And I want to get up there when the meeting starts to keep your point of review, and if you excuse me, I'll start right now. Is that all right?
Yeah, I'm always trying.
I'm going to say about you is that I just came from the White House. I'm not going to say what you said. I just came from the White House and you put this in to be vetoed, so what do you want to have me do? So I won't say vetoed.
Let me say this.
You heard that.
I don't like to usually put these in personal terms, but let me tell you, just let's lay it right out here. The does anybody around this table doubt that not only have we, that we have been enormously successful in ending the war in Vietnam and ending it in a way that would accomplish our limited objective of a Vietnam, which is not taking us to the continent, and also ending it in a way that would reduce our casualties and so forth? Nobody doubts that. Does anybody doubt that we're going to do it just as soon as we can? Does anybody doubt that we are working every hour, waiting hour that we can for the release of prisoners? Does anybody doubt that if there was any kind of a deal that we could possibly make on the prisoner deal that would be consistent with our interests, that we wouldn't make it? No. The question is this: put yourself in the position of the enemy. Basically, amendments which tie the hands of the prisoner as against an enemy that has no restraints can only play into the hands of the enemy. Makes it more difficult. You're going to make it more difficult to negotiate what we want to do, to negotiate and to bring, because the prisoner thing is a negotiation business. I mean, you can't let it go. I mean, we've got to make a deal. And anytime you not if they lack confidence in our intentions or our ability, that's one thing. But for the Congress to say, well, the way to do this, the way to conduct this thing, the Congress, without knowing what the hell is going on, and they didn't do it. But for the Congress to say, well, we believe the way to get the prisoners back is to make an offer, which the enemy has already turned down. That is, that we'll get out in a time certain, provided they release the prisoners. So they turned that down. So the Congress puts that in legislation. Then where the hell do you think it's going to end up? That's really what we have here. I believe me, I look. Don't you think for 1 minute that I would have said this myself if I thought that would do the trick? Of course. But you got to say to me, would we like to get the credit? Would you say, Jerry, who's going to get the credit here? I know how you guys have fought this. So you know, what about the decision? I'm sorry, is it, whether the Republican or Democrat's going to get the credit? Yeah, but I'm not sure that there's a whole lot in the law. Because They may be right, I mean they're wrong. But they then, if the Congress moves in and in effect takes the place of the president in the field of foreign policy in a delicate negotiation, then the Congress assumes the responsibility for the success or failure of those negotiations. I assume the responsibility myself. Congress wants to do it, believe me, we're going to make it pay. Now that's all there is to it. And all those people that voted that way didn't look very damn good. Well, we'll have to get you all down to town. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm this member of a presidentially appointed.
Yeah, I was glad to see that. Well, by the way, you got a sense, you got something.
Not 80 years, 70. He was also a presidential scholar.
How old
is he? 80 years for the MENA.
So we turn this way so we can get our official photograph here, which they can use. This is Mr. Atkinson. Makes the best pictures in our room. Now he
department.
Yes, he does. We may issue you a copy of it, I would say, and put it out in the press. Make it recorded where you did. Ken is one of the charter members of the youth organization for charter children. He's the past president of it. I'm a freshman at Harvard now. Joe Douglas and I were first associated in ACW when I came in 1956. He was already there. He's held a series of important jobs in ACW and with federal governments, including the several posts in the National Institute of Mental Health. He recently headed the initial work in organizing the White House Conference of Children and Youth. He's now the director of this committee. I suppose before asking members of the committee to fill you in on some of the most important things that they're doing, I might just touch briefly on what seems to me an extraordinary phenomenon in itself. That is that at our time and at this particular moment, there is a greater degree of concern for the retarded than there has been at any previous time, or it's fair to say, in any other society. I think we could well regard this as...
By society, you don't mean any other country. I suppose there's some countries that do, smaller countries do a better job than we do, would you say?
I think there's some that do as well, but I think it's on a better class of the total effort and when you think also of the involvement of individual citizens.
Volunteer.
That while there may be countries that have programs,
I agree.
But I think really as a mark in a sense of the quality of a civilization, the ways in which people seek to reach out to the handicapped and helpless is probably the single most significant indicator. And so the present committee serves in effect to try to bring together into a more effective total relationship programs that occur not only throughout ACW but in many other parts of the government. In ACW alone, there are some 54 different programs that touch needs and problems of retarded in one way or another, with total appropriations in fiscal 72 of some $668 million, which is up from about $377 million in fiscal 68. Now, one might well say, why can't you put 54 programs into one or into a few? I'm sure we can consolidate in some places, and this is one of the first questions, you know, a major effort in itself. But there is no way, really, that this whole effort can be confined to just a very few programs, because it extends across the whole range, obviously, from basic research into the genetic causes of some forms of retardation, the problems of neonatal development, the kinds of environmental influences that can bring about retardation, the needs of the severely retarded for residential care, the development of programs of education and training for those who are trainable and eligible, community involvement in various forms, income maintenance, support for those who are not otherwise adequately able to support themselves. So these efforts do extend across a very broad range. And the role of the President's Committee is within the government to try to assure the maximum synergistic impact of the interrelationships among these programs, while also seeking to enlist the commitment and participation of state, local governments, and voluntary agencies. There has been a function primarily of identifying priority needs and opportunities, and then, having done this, to develop policy recommendations and to involve all of the participants in the execution of these recommendations. with the new vice chairmanship of Senator Bergener and the Joe Douglas is as executive director, they have been reviewing the work of the committee and seeking to chart new directions for it. And I think now to tell you about these, the appropriate for me to turn next to Senator Bergener.
Thank you very much. It's my interest in an honest private on that the lovely lady on your left and I think that in two people in the room that happen to be parents of the target children in our as our political paths brushed over the years, I don't think we've ever mentioned that, but we too are and no one else here. But this is kind of typical of our movement. It's a good mixture of parents of retarded and professional people and citizen volunteers, and it works very well. My little contribution to this has to do with about 200,000 people who are mentally retarded. They live in institutions. And how we think we can take at least a third of them, bring them out of the institution, and bring them back to the community.
I saw those figures. There are 200,000 institutions, and there are approximately 6 million. And we have another country retarded. The others now are already living in homes. It's
great. Various places. They're all over the place. Some of their own families.
But you think you're going to say that even that small, hardcore of 200,000 could be.
Oh, indeed.
It's not going to be there. Now, the other point that I made is this, where, what about the 6 million? Or the 5,800,000 that are not in institutions, are some of those, should they have institutional care? Is that
the I think not. They need to be totally integrated into all of the things that are happening in the community.
That's the important thing. In other words, I think that gets answers my question. And our real goal here is not to cart people away and put them in institutions, but our real goal is to get them out of institutions and in society and families, get them accepted, have them make their contributions to the extent they can.
Well, exactly, and have the fears of the public who don't know about them.
Right.
We all fear the unknown. It's a national people. And now, if we get them out of the institution, why should we do it, and what do we do with them when we get them out?
Right.
Well, maybe some would come back to their own homes. Some would go to foster homes. Some would go to smaller, maybe a 200-bed facility, either public or private. The smaller the better. You can't take a 4,000-bed institution and call it a home. It just isn't. It isn't a home. Some would go into special classes in the public schools, some would go to Shelby Workshop. But independent living for the adult retarded is very important. It's normal for our own kids when they achieve adulthood, age 21, 23, 19, to move out. Not because we don't love them, but because they have to get self-independence. The same is true for the handicapped. And the only way they're going to feel self-value and worth is to kind of be on their own. Now, in the Scandinavian countries, this is one area where we're a little bit behind them. They've done a beautiful job at this. The adult handicapped go out and live in little cluster housing with kind of marginal supervision from the site. We can do a lot of that if we will. Now, it's expensive to keep them in these, well, we call them lots of things, stay home, state hospital. You remember Pacific State near Pomona, we used to call it Pacific Colony. They go by lots of different names, but they're a substitute home, and you got 3,000 or 4,000 beds, they're not much of a home. So it costs $15,000 to $20,000 a bed to build one of these places, and equipment, buy the land. That's expensive. Then it costs $4,000 to $5,000 for the taxpayers to keep the person in there annually to maintain them. So we can do it a lot better, a lot cheaper back in the community, and then the human values are just immense by having these people really belong to society. We all tend, and we parents are the most guilty of all, we tend to be too protective, we tend to underestimate what our youngsters can do. That's why we need professionals like Dr. Douglas and the Secretary and others who could be more objective than we, and particularly the young people like Ken Robbins and come in, and they have no limitations on their horizon. Some of us who are older think we can't do much. These young people show us how we can do all kinds of things. So that, in bringing them back to the community, why this is a every reason why we should do this.
You know, the interesting thing you say, though, is we're running at cross currents here. It seems to me when you said that we tend to be too protective, that's just about retarded. The tendency in our society today is for us to be far too protective about young people, you know, generally, you know what I mean? don't want to let them get on the phone so far, and rather than, and if you carry that over, then on the retarded thing, you're running against that current by, as a, we think sometimes we do a favor to a child. I'm referring to a non-retarded child, a favor to a child, by doing many things for him or her. And many things, many times, and none of us like to be cruel. The worst thing you can do is to do too much for the child, right?
Exactly.
As a retarded thing, encourages him. I remember a great, you remember Elliot, all of your convention in 60 Water Jets, and a keynote speech where he showed this wonderful example. He said about his daughter. Because his daughter always used to ask him to help her with her arithmetic. And he said, and what I could have done, she says, I could do her arithmetic for her. She says, I could do it better, and it would take me less time. But he says, I didn't do it for her. And he says, not because I didn't love her, but because I did love her. She had to do it herself. You know, that's really that's the problem we got. Throughout our society, I digress a bit here, but I think it runs right into this. You take a retarded child, or for the a non-retarded child that's not developed, or the other, and we all think, gee, listen, I keep that kid who's got something, just gotta push him in the water and make him sweat out. But it's not cruel. It's the only right thing to do. That's like, just as bad as anybody else, sometimes you have to make the mother feel the their daughter. Go right ahead.
Well, I think perhaps, Dr.
Why don't we wind up with Joe and ask, who's you and next to?
Well, I'm going to turn to Kenny, who has, I think, some remarks he'd like to make.
Well, Mr. President, I'd like to talk about the youth involved in the field of mental retardation. One of the most difficult problems in mental retardation, of course, is ensuring that mentally retarded persons have a useful and meaningful life. And I'm sure you're aware that countless mentally retarded people have been left in the past and still stay to vegetate in institutions and in private homes where no assistance is offered them. Well, in October 1968, Youth NARC, the National Youth National Association for Retarded Children, was formed with the primary purpose, the primary concept of filling this void thus formed in the minds of retarded persons by providing a tete-a-tete, extremely interpersonal relationship between young people and as many mentally retarded persons as possible. In an unprecedented, concerted national effort of young people to ameliorate the lives of these mentally retarded persons by providing for their emotional, psychological, and physical well-being, our membership in Youth NARC now has reached 30,000 in 46 states within 4 years. We feel this is an indication that young people indeed have found that mental retardation is a cause to which we can become devoted, and that there is something we can do as young people to supplement what is already being done by adults. Besides our direct activities to the mentally retarded, which by the way comes in the form of recreational activities, physical development exercises, and cultural enrichment programs, our young people have become involved in another major emphasis which parallels one of the President's Committee, and that is one of public awareness and public education in the field of mental retardation. We find that our volunteers have done much to focus the attention of the community and young people on the problems and the solutions unique to the field of mental retardation. We find that very often the media is more receptive to young people coming to it with a new innovative approach to the problems of mental retardation, focusing the attention of the community on it. Unfortunately, many of our associations, many of our adult associations from the local level have been unable to work as effectively, perhaps as possible, simply because the media is not receptive to the type of input they're giving them. So young people, we have found, are able to get into the media, are able to get more so into the homes, into the individual homes of the community, and get our concepts over concerning mental retardation. To give you a general idea of some other things that young people actually can do in the field of mental retardation, I again must refer to youth inheritance, because I say that before youth inheritance was formed, to our knowledge, there really had not been, again, a concerted national effort of youth to go into the field and to really affect great changes in the field as young people. So I might say that we are now substantially supplementing the manpower in the field simply because we are providing many students who have an interest in relevant paraprofessional and professional careers. We found that in the past, young people who had been going into college, perhaps thinking of in majoring in fields relevant to mental retardation, would drop out of those majors simply because of lack of funds, because of lack of interest. And so we are, the whole scope of young people in the colleges now is changing, simply because our volunteers have had the introduction to the field before they go into college. They realize at that time that this is what they want to do, and that there is something as young people and as paraprofessionals or professionals they can perhaps do. So we believe that we are supplementing substantially the manpower in the field. We are now becoming actively involved in legislative affairs concerning mental retardation on the state and local level. We hope that eventually our influence as young people, especially as voters now in 18 and above parades, will carry over to the federal level, but we are now influencing legislative affairs on the state and local level. We've had some very remarkable instances of this legislative involvement in the Idaho and Michigan and Wisconsin state legislatures, where we have been influential in passing residential services legislation. Of course, we are seeking to coordinate our activities with Youth NARC with the other volunteer activities of other national youth service-oriented organizations. And I might add that within the last few years, this type of organization has become much more frequently prevalent in our society. At the time Youth NARC was formed in 68, there were very few national youth organizations. We find that the Youth March of Dimes now has become very actively involved. United Cerebral Palsy has instituted a youth organization. The Council for Exceptional Children has a very active student agency. So we also seek to coordinate our activities with these, again, to give a much more comprehensive scope of youth involvement in the field. Indeed, we have found in by our involvement that youth can effectively supplement what is being done by the families in the home and by the overworked staff in the institution to aid the mental retardant. We believe, as I have said, that we have found a cause and we are devoting ourselves to that, seeking to constructively improve our society. We trust that the media understands that we are not perhaps the more vocal majority of young people that constantly attacking our society, but that we are an extremely active majority of young people seeking really to get in and do something about the conditions that are prevalent in our society. And there's so many things that can be done by young people in the field of mental retardation.
When did you become interested?
I became interested about 8 years ago. It was a very personal introduction when I met the son of my family doctor, who is a Mongoloid.
Oh, I see.
It was from that introduction I gathered an interest and sought to go out into the community and really devote myself to helping out. Right. I really had just turned 10. Right?
Late start.
Right. Yes, sir.
And you kept studying in high school. I mean, you kept interested in the volunteer activities.
Indeed, right. I was 13 when Youth NARC was formed. And, of course, I was a ninth grader in junior high.
Working for high school.
Of the Pearl High School in Nashville, Tennessee.
Tennessee.
A public school.
Yeah, I went to Harvard.
There. Right, yes, sir. I'm a freshman.
So we turn to Joe Douglas, President Pat Hitt. She would like to add a couple of words. She is here as Secretary for Community and Field Services at HEW. Would you
which is really a sort of parent for the work of the President's Committee in AGW. So that's there as to the show business.
Briefly, I think mental retardation is almost the only field that I have never been involved in as a volunteer in my whole life. I done just about it, you control just about everything else there is to be done. And I think that my whole experience, thanks to you, Mr. President, here in Washington at ACW, would be, if I had to point to the one thing, the one vista that has opened up for me that was new, other than being a part of federal bureaucracy, it would be the opening up of this area and a new process, which has had a tremendous impact on me. I think Kennedy is probably one of the greatest inspirations I've ever had. I first met him at one of the first conventions where he presided, and about 2 years ago, I shared a half-hour television, educational television program, and I can tell you that it's the first time in my whole life I was delighted to be upstage and have it taken away from me by someone else. But because here's an example of a young man who is very consistent in the work he does, is touching on the lives of thousands, all apologies to our generation, is touching on the lives of thousands and thousands of people. And as a result of Ken and the young people like him, there are literally tens of thousands of mentally retarded who will have a better life, a better chance, and enriched. So to me, he's a tremendous inspiration. If you didn't know Julie yesterday, I haven't had time to talk to her, but I understand from Jim that she was quite enthusiastic about her bit. So she can do a lot for us too.
Yes, but that way the mayor of Cleveland, her, has a retarded child, and she visited the institution in Cleveland where his child was, so this is interesting. Quite a gal.
Oh.
I'd like to do that. Now, Mr. Head, I'm the president of such a welcome as opportunity to talk with you concerning this major problem. We feel today that the opportunity for this actually to reduce incidence and prevalence of mentalization by about 50%. The last decade has shown tremendous development in biomedical and physical areas, as well as in the behavioral sciences. We also know
is most of this have to be prenatal, or is it?
I would say a good portion would be prenatal. I did try to, but it's all preventive side that you're talking about. Now, you're not talking about what players, you're not talking about what you do with the toilet, but how we prevent the incidence of the retardation. So I'm talking about that in the main, because I think that's perhaps the most major convening, but also the great caucus of the retarded on functional error, mislabeled, misdiagnosed in institutions because of another place to take them, the absence of early enrichment programs, and the embryonic development, etc. So that perhaps the great push should be in the scholarly operation of this mislabeled group. Another category would be those that have chronic illnesses or other anomalies very early in infancy, which if pursued or is following the course, could result in mental contamination. And another, of course, is a preventive area. And you know, we all have to realize that there is a very fine line between which retarded and which not. The illness factor. I have seen, for example, even around this table in congressional leaders, individuals who went through a very serious illness recently, they're an operator and so forth. The attack for months afterwards, that may be, I mean, you would say, well, retardation, if it worked, but it was a physical cause. If you take a child, and the rest, I suppose it's, and I know it goes to much more complicated things, but we press the other side of the coin, as we all know, the psychosomatic.
I think this is a fascinating field, and very important to grab, to get a hold of it.
And one of the more common forms of misdiagnosis in field retardation is that was fundamentally an emotional illness on the part of the child, which can result in behavior that makes the child inaccessible and withdrawn, and therefore not part of the learning process and so on.
The emotional behaviors are of all the fields, I've read a lot in this field, of all the fields, this has to be emotional because it's the unknown. In a sense it is. We look back, of course, to, we all go back a century, or maybe a half a century, and just put everybody in homes. I mean, this and that and the other thing, you know. And there was something wrong about it, you know. Something wrong with the family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But now, at least we have, it's a great thing that the country has advanced to the point we don't look at it that way anymore. We look upon it as an opportunity rather than something else. But still, there's this gray area of the unknown. I mean, we all these studies children, what happens to the nutrition problem works out of the physical problem and all the rest of it. And of course, this whole area, of course, as I'm sure you're aware too, it's a field that unfortunately brings in an enormous, I mean, there are quacks on the physical side, but there's an enormous number of quacks on this side, I mean, who make people sick who really are, you know, that's the other side of this. Go ahead.
Well, we think the ways, perhaps, if we use this model, as to say, we can reduce or prevent retardation in the very instance by some 15 to 20%. We think we can reduce the reflection of mental retardation through correcting chronic diseases, etc., by about 10 to 15%. And we really think that anywhere possibly 20 to 25% of these salvage from this mislabeling and inability, you know, inaccessibility to the delivery systems and health, education, and welfare, and other opportunity structures in our society. On the preventive end, I think perhaps we can make very strong progress in the next 20 years because of the amount of outreach of developments. I'd like to run through just a few. The whole area of genetic counseling, with reference to hereditary diseases, so-called carrier detection. There are now about 27 known hereditary aspects which can be identified. And you're pretty sure, yes, 27 have been. The X number, of course, do not, but 27 affirm. The whole question of the incompatibility of the RH cycle in the mother and child, which is a new development, and the prevention of hemolytic diseases for the newborn. This question is now the ability now to survey or to say surveillance of the prenatal period for modeling the fetal growth and development to reduce the incidence of low weight births, as if not progressing normally, not to nutrition or that needs to get the baby to size should be when born.
There is a high correlation between prematurity and mental retardation,
and also low birth weight.
So that whatever is done along these lines, including, among other things, the emphasis which is part of the family planning and prenatal and postnatal care efforts that are going on as a result of initiatives you've taken are helping now to cut down premature. Getting mothers simply to come in for prenatal examinations on a regular basis, which a great many mothers in disadvantaged neighborhoods have not been doing, is contributing.
Yes, there's a high correlation between the general well-being and health of the mother in terms of the diseases she might have, diseases of the liver, heart, the pancreas, and other things of this nature. Organizationally, the identification of high-risk populations, mothers and children, those who are not in pediatric care to the health system. There's a tremendous expertise now available in the whole area of obstetrics care, so that birth asphyxia, brain damage to the young child during the point of birth, that can be prevented.
That's what happened to
being a well, totally normal baby, or on the other hand, the development of the fetal lung, the extent to which, by the beginning of the second trimester, the baby's lung is not developed to the point so that it can make the transition into birth later, then the parent is counseled that perhaps this should continue with that pregnancy. These are some of the major causes, of course, of immunization. These were particularly in advance of the part of young ladies. Now, there are many indications in terms of how best to bring to bear the available knowledge and techniques in the community setting, so that with existing resources, federal, state, and local, voluntary, and professional, concentrated attack can be made in solid doctrines to prevent attack and care and treatment. This, of course, extends over to institutions because we have a better education system. This is one way of understanding it. Take then that a 50% reduction within 30 years based on developing knowledge is certainly going to be the most possible.
Senator, you might be interested in knowing that we have recently initiated a program of prevention directed towards the potential mother on the high school level concerning prenatal care and also concerning the high risk of birth of children with mental deficiencies where the mother has used an excess of certain drugs to let my babies and what have you. So this is also another thrust that we are seeking to work on a youth-to-youth basis and informing potential mothers.
May I mention one brief thing, about 30 seconds? Last month, your Committee on Mental Retardation conducted the first Pacific Forum on Mental Retardation in Honolulu. It wasn't held there because that's a nice place to go, which it is, but there were 17 Pacific nations that participated. Japan, Singapore, Australia, Philippines, and all of them. And we had a three-day thing that was just outstanding. We exchanged information. You find that compared to other, a little bit on the feminine side, I would say. Whereas compared to Scandinavian countries, some of those are ahead of us in smaller areas. Overall, I think we're doing the best job of all. But they passed a unanimous resolution commending you and the committee for doing this. I didn't know if you were aware, but us being out there. But it was an outstanding event, and the first we hope of others to follow. Because we would have to share information from all these countries. There were 17 of them, from all over, including Japan. We didn't have People's Republic, but we had we really had a fine meeting. And already the American Association on Mental Deficiency, which is primarily medical doctors, offered to give them their total library in all these countries free.
Good.
And that's sort of thing. I just want to touch on.
Well, we'd like to go forth, Mr. President, brief the press, which, with the emphasis of the statement that has been prepared for you to issue, which targets these three major areas.
Well, if you
that will, I think, help to.
Yes, you never know. You never know what the press will cover. Don't be disappointed if you see it here in papers here, because sometimes it will fly out of the country, you know, and that's the important thing. It's just to keep working on it.
Well, the big parents and
they'll consider it. If you don't see it, it may be important, but it's something you just got to keep pounding it out. Eventually, some of it seeps through and the wires are stirring the crop up, say, in Billings, Montana, or something like that, and that affects the family and so forth. And maybe a life has changed, and that is all your meeting is worthwhile. Just one.
I want to thank you for your time, all of you,
but more for the work you're in. This is has to be a labor's love, and we are. Here are
that's 20 years. If you look at the figures year after year, they go up and down. Statistics ruin the healthcare, the money goes down, and so forth. But if each of you could just put it in terms of one person, it would help one person, one person.
What arise would live a life,
speaking now of a retired person or an individual or a child, and give us hope for that. If one man's life has changed as a result of this, then also, putting on the preventive side, we can make some progress preventing in the future. One family or that one child is worth it. That's why you're most of your illness. You've got to. But and don't be discouraged by the fact that, sometimes your appropriations aren't as big as they are. Sometimes the numbers aren't as encouraging as they are. Sometimes maybe you should breakthroughs aren't as big as they are. The main thing is that there's a lot of people who care about what you're doing. Most important.
Now I'd like to give you a little memento here. I'll get the presidential couple. There's yours. Thank you.
Thank you.
You don't have to wear a cuff. I said, I don't know what it comes from you.
Go wear a cuff some more. But see what we got for later.
Oh, my, sir. Yeah. Here's what mine.
Oh, we got a little gimmick, a little compact for you. So, do you have a compact picture?
No, but I have
Well, I'm having a meeting.
Oh, I'm meeting. All right.
I'm inviting you to attend.
Yeah, I got it. All right. Okay. I can't get you in there. No, I'll fly down and send it. All right. Thank you very much. You're attendee.
Are you on the
system? You knew all the numbers. I know. I mean, you knew all those easy. You were throwing out those medical terms so easily that I don't even see an MD. It impressed me. Thank you. Very nice to see you. Good luck with you.
Thank you very much.
What do you try to do when you finish college?
Well, I'm in biology now, so I have to go back to med school.
Med school?
Yes.
Good. We got enough good lawyers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, you were excellent.
You let her idea.
Thank you.
Check in with
Yeah.
Oh, we got a whole other place in here.